Hello, and welcome to the second August 19, 2022 episode of a special Friday twofer of the musical universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or the estate of any performer or composer dead and gone to discuss their music and or recordings. Now with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guest today is Dallas, Texas-based singer-songwriter and producer Salim Nurala. Today is the release of Salim's newest recording, an EP entitled See You in Marfa. The EP is a result of a collaboration between Nurala and British guitarist, songwriter, producer Marty Wilson Piper. During the fall of 2018, Nurala assembled his longtime band, John DeFillo, Joe Reyes, Richard Martin, and Jason Garner, for the first time since 2011's acclaimed Hit Parade, a record which AllMusic called a superb album from a master of contemporary pop. Joined by Wilson Piper, the group of musicians cut an album and a half's worth of songs in a Nashville studio called Welcome to 1979. Plans to release a full-length album of the material fell through when the COVID-19 pandemic struck in March of 2020 and forced Wilson Piper to cancel plans to come to the United States and tour with Nurala. A decision was made to indefinitely shelve the album, A Nuclear Winter, until Wilson Piper was able to come back to America and the two musicians could resume touring plans. The five-song See You in Marfa EP includes bonus material from the Nashville sessions, as well as Hold On to the Night, a song Nurala and Wilson Piper co-wrote, and the EP serves as a teaser for the forthcoming, still-to-be-scheduled album. When asked to sum up his 25-year career in music, songwriter-producer Salim Nurala says, "I feel like the Texas version of Nick Lowe, except I haven't entered my silver-haired crooner phase yet." When he was a kid, Nurala looked up to Lowe, mainly because he was the best example teenage Salim could find of a musician who led a double life of sorts, making his own records while also producing other artists. It's still a relatively uncommon phenomenon. Salim Nurala has been releasing solo albums since 2003. His notable production credits include The Old 97s, Death Ray Davies, Rhett Miller and the Damwells. Nurala has been recording and producing music from his Pleasantry Lane studios in Dallas for as many years as he's been making his own. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Salim Nurala. Hello, Salim.
Hello. Good to see you.
It's great to see you, and it's great to talk with you. And I'm very happy to have you as a guest on my show today.
Well,
A
I'm happy to be
question.
here.
Well, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. A question that I ask almost every musician that I interview, because I'm curious, is who or what turned the light on for you? What motivated you to play guitar, sing, and write songs?
Well, that's a very good question, and I of course know the answer. After I tell you, I'd like to know what your guess would be. Maybe I should ask you what your guess would be. Who do you think? Where do you think I'm coming from with all
Well,
this?
I would tell you what most people tell me,
Yeah.
and that is that they had a either parents or an older sibling who played, and they became kind of enraptured with it all and decided to try it themselves.
Yeah.
Or I've had one where the parents gave them a little toy guitar when they were about 4, 5, 6 years old, started playing around with it, and then later wanted to do the real thing. So there's a
Yeah.
lot of different stories. That's why I always like to ask, because everyone has a different origin story.
Well, mine doesn't have to do with parents giving me a toy guitar. My father was a Syrian immigrant,
Oh, okay.
thus my complicated and difficult name. And he didn't even know who the Beatles were, even though he was of the age. He would have been in his 20s when the Beatles were doing their thing. And my mother, who was a Michigan girl and met my father at the University of Illinois, she was a classical music nerd, and she didn't even really know about the Beatles. And I'm mentioning the Beatles because the Beatles are really who are responsible for me. I
Okay.
just happened to be, even though I was born in Illinois in the Midwest, I moved with my family when I was three to El Paso, which
Okay.
is a very desolate place in West Texas. And I discovered the Beatles when I was about 9 years old and really responsible for everything. So
Okay.
I've been sending the bills to Paul McCartney. He hasn't reimbursed me yet, but it's all his fault.
Sure. Okay. Well, that doesn't surprise me in some ways, because they
Yeah.
were Lennon and McCartney were in many ways consummate songwriters. I mean, they wrote some awesome lyrics, came up
Yeah.
with some melodies. I mean, and there's a testament to the fact that their music is still played quite frequently
Sure.
today. Yeah.
Yeah. They were pretty
Yeah.
good, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they blew my mind as a kid, and it really opened up all of these possibilities that I'm still sort of enraptured with, which is that popular music is, it's not just the music, it's so much. It's like photography and fashion and everything. And it runs the gamut. Like there are so many things that you can do with it. And the Beatles, to me, are they set it all up, you know?
Well, they really certainly were representative of the culture of their time.
Yeah.
When I used to teach history of rock and roll, I used to like compare the Beatles and the Stones, which was something that seemed to always kind of be going on. There was even, of course, manufactured rivalries between the two bands. And the idea was that throughout their career, the Stones kind of solidified the core of rock and roll, which was the blues,
Yeah.
whereas the Beatles took rock and roll in many, many different directions. I mean, really experimented with it and all the different things that you could do with it.
Well, I gotta ask you a question. Have you heard
Sure.
the song? Have you heard the song? It's called The Beatles and the Stones.
Off top of my head, I think I have at some point, but I don't remember the song right now.
Well, there's a great British group that I loved and still love called The House of Love. And they had a song called The Beatles and the Stones that's really cool. And I think you'd like it. And anybody who's listening, But check out The Beatles and the Stones by House of Love.
Okay, I'll do that when we get done
Yeah.
here. Yeah, they were interesting in too in comparing like the social class that each group came from and where they went and their musical influences and things. And but I agree. I think the Beatles music, I mean, it's still incredibly present in our culture today. And I think certainly led the way in a lot of ways.
Well, I wonder sometimes. I look at the charts. I don't really see much evidence that the Beatles existed. I still avidly listen to a lot of modern music. I don't feel the Beatles' presence a whole lot. I'm definitely what I call a son of the Beatles, and I think that over the last 30 or 40 years of music, I think we have lots of sons and daughters of the Beatles. Some of the ones that come to mind are Neil Finn and Robin Hitchcock and John Bryan. And I mean, there's plenty of sons of the Beatles. And Amy Mann kind of comes to mind as a daughter of the Beatles. And but I'm definitely in the category of what I would call a son of the Beatles.
Well, I was very intrigued. Me and maybe you have seen it. There's a documentary out about their last recording session. And
Yeah, get back.
I can't, I guess that's the name. I don't recall the name of it, but I've watched it's in several episodes. And I was just intrigued by how they worked. They would be sitting there, sitting around, and either John Lennon or Paul McCartney would get an idea and start singing or playing something on their guitars, and then Ringo would add a drum beat they thought it'd work. They'd stop. They'd go back. They had another guy off to the side that was writing down lyrics because they were extemporizing lyrics. They were just like they'd get an idea for a lyric and say, let's write that down, and they would come back to review it. Interesting documentary. Interesting way that they worked, and certainly an important part of world culture and musical culture, that's for sure.
Well, I
Well,
agree.
yeah. Well, what usually motivates you to write a song?
Well, when I first started writing as a teenager, it was strictly as a tool to deal with life. And it was a form of self-therapy for me. It just helped me cope. I was the son of an immigrant. There was a culture clash. I didn't feel like I fit in. As a kid, I had a weird name. I had glasses. There was, life was kind of fraught, and music was my escape. And it eventually became my way of working things out. And just I called it taking out the trash, like when I was the emotional trash, like when I was experiencing or trying to process difficult things. I use music and writing as a form of therapy, and I guess I've continued that into my adult years. Like, I do believe that music should also be fun, and it shouldn't just be an expression of one. I think one, going back to the Beatles again, I think something that the Beatles really taught me was that there is, you don't feel one emotion all the time, and I don't either. Human beings, we run this gamut. In one day, you could move through any number of emotions, and music should reflect that. You shouldn't be, I've never had any interest in being an artist that just did like one thing, like shoegaze or everything is up and everything is poppy and everything is fun. I've just like the music is a reflection of all the different moods and shades and feelings. So yeah, that's how I've used it over the years.
Well, that really leads nicely into my next question, because we know that the ancient Greeks claimed that the purpose of tragedy in drama was to serve as an emotional catharsis for those who were witnessing the drama. One could experience the emotional pain of what they were seeing on stage without experiencing the actual pain itself from what was being viewed. So then, aside from yourself, do you feel like the aesthetic purpose of your songs is to provide an emotional cleansing for your listeners? Or are you, as other songwriters have done, simply serving as an observer of human relationships and making some personal commentary about them?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think, I'm observing, but I'm also working out my own stuff. And I want people, like any writer would like, is you'd like to have someone relate to it. But I'm already, it doesn't really, one good thing for me is it doesn't really matter if the world connects with what I'm doing. Like, it's already served its purpose for me. It's already helped me. It's already done something good for me. And I'm a firm believer in enjoying the process. So I've already enjoyed the process of making these recordings and doing it usually with my friends. And so something get if someone hears it then and gets something out of it, then that's a bonus. That's great. And if it's a cathartic thing for them, wonderful. If it's just, it can also just be a fun thing, because there are songs that are not deep introspective ruminations on, on the state of the world. So it runs the gamut. So hopefully that answers your question. I think it's
Well, yeah.
multiple.
I think it does, and I've had a number of singer-songwriters that have kind of said sort of the same thing, in that when they create music, when they create or write a song, it may have a particular meaning or a particular perspective to them, and once that's done, you can't be responsible how anybody else is going to take it, in some ways. I just happened to think about, many years ago, Randy Newman came out with a song entitled Short People. And he took a tremendous amount of flack over that song because people said, oh, you're making fun of, people who aren't tall. People did not recognize the thinly veiled sarcasm that he was putting across. Actually making fun of bigotry, not making fun of short people per se. And so, like you said, it's nice when other people get it, but you're talking about a personal expression that may or may not directly relate to anyone else. And it's nice when it does, but it's not necessarily a requirement for you, is what I understand. Well,
I think the greatest compliments over the years is these messages I've got from people. Like, for example, was on a plane landing in Italy, and your song was on came on, and people traveling, and if a song can become part of the soundtrack to someone's life, I think that that's the coolest thing that you can do with music or ever hope to be is someone out there experiencing a special moment in their life, and your music somehow was a part of it. That's a cool thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Well, when kind of getting to the mechanics of songwriting, when you are inspired to write a song, what usually comes first? Is it a lyric, or is it a melody, a rhythm, or a set of chord changes, a mood? What usually strikes first?
Well, these days it seems to be triggered by lyrics. I keep a running bunch of notes on my phone, because the phone has become the master of the universe.
Yes, carry our brains in our pockets, don't we?
So, but over the years, it's been any number of things. Like there are times where I just started singing something. Like I have a song called Good Sense and Safety that came out last year, I think. And I was just in my garage and I started singing, "When I was a boy, my dad told me the rules of life." And I was just sing it to myself, and I recorded it on my phone, and that ended up becoming this song. And other times, I have an old song called Terlingua that I was on the way back from Target of all places with my son, who was he's now he's 19, but he was a little guy back then. And I just started singing, "Are we gonna live? Are we gonna live tonight?" And that became this song. So sometimes I've just plugged in a drum machine and like started a beat. I have a song called Permanent Holiday that started with a beat and a bass line. But I think it's important to mix it up, because the longer you go, the more records you make. We all have things that are the most comfortable, and it begins to get a little bit boring. And not, I think it gets boring for the listener too. If you, I'm going to kick back to the Beatles, for example. You know, the Beatles were a group that started writing songs predominantly 100% on guitar, but McCartney and Lennon started writing on piano. And when they started writing on piano, they blew the doors off the system. And if you look at the songs that Paul McCartney wrote on piano, they're mind-blowing, including Lennon, who wrote Imagine on piano. So I think that was a lesson in mix it up. Don't just write on one instrument. Just don't do the same thing over and over again. My most comfortable way of writing songs is with an acoustic guitar. I've got an idea for a song, I've got a lyric, I've got a title. Sometimes the song just almost writes itself if I have a title. I had a title. It was a one-word title. It was just Damage. And I knew the song. I knew what the song was going to be before, and then I wrote it. So I just keep trying to mix it up, because at this point I've been making records for a long, long time, and I've got probably too many, and I need to keep it for myself, like jumping around and not just using the same formula that's easy for me, which that formula would be acoustic guitar and a lyric idea go. So
I
that's
hear
what I,
you.
yeah.
No, I hear you. I mean, it's just like sometimes you have to repot a plant to get it to grow better, you
That's
know?
right. You're
And
I
yeah,
love that idea.
I hear you, because you need sometimes you need a change of environment, a change of stimulus, a change of just like you said, the way you do things, so you don't get stale.
For sure.
So you don't get too much into a rut. Well,
Yeah.
anyway, well, let's get to your new EP that's coming out today. I mean, our interview's on Wednesday, but
Sure.
people will be
Yeah.
hearing it on Friday, August 19th. And let's talk about some of the songs on the new EP.
Okay.
The song "See You in Marfa."
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you my interpretation or how the song came to me, and then you can either tell me I'm wrong or agree. It doesn't matter. Because maybe I can take it a lot differently than you did. But
Well,
it's a
I already
it's a
like this idea. It's more fun for me to hear your interpretation.
okay, all right. But at least it's a point of departure for a discussion.
Yeah, for
There is
sure.
no right or wrong. It's just different ideas here. But anyway,
Exactly.
"See You in Marfa," as I listened to it a number of times, it just comes across to me as a wonderfully upbeat, positive love song about you're sharing the desert with your significant other.
Yeah.
And so my question is, was this song inspired by an excellent personal experience?
Well, it was indeed inspired by an excellent personal experience. So the song is about is almost 8 years old, and it's an example too of my patience, maybe. But 8 years ago, I had come out of a really turbulent time relationship, and I was looking. I was on the search for about a year for something peaceful, and I met a girl, and we were sort of falling in love, and I was pretty sure that she was going to be the one, but we were in the early phase, in the early stages, so you never know, you know. Mm-hmm. And I had a gig in Marfa at a place called El Cosmico, and El Cosmico is a very interesting place because it's basically trailers. It's like a hotel, but you stay in trailers. And part of my pay for the gig was to stay in this trailer. And I invited her to come to this show with me and thought it would be sort of a romantic thing. And I wasn't planning on writing a song or anything or doing any of that nonsense. I'm not really like a love song guy. Like, I mm-hmm. think that there are certain writers that I think of, even Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney's written so many great love songs. Billy Joel comes to mind, maybe you have. Do you have any top love song writer?
Well, you know, it's hard to get past just the way you are and, you know, Billy Joel and things that McCartney wrote. I can't think of a great love song or songwriter, but I can think of a great line from a mystery novel by a Japanese author that I read one time that used the metaphor, losing you would be like having Bobby Darin's greatest hits and not Mac the Knife.
That's a good line.
You know, I mean, well, that's a really like an interesting metaphor, like, right? When you consider that was maybe one of his biggest hits, you know. Yeah. So, you know, love songs are, there's a lot of great ones out there.
There are a lot. There are.
I guess my favorite standard is I've Never Been in Love Before, which is from the musical Kiss Me, Kate.
Yeah.
And it was made famous, at least for me, by jazz trumpet player Chet Baker when he sang it. Yeah.
Well, that's a classic.
Yes.
Love songs, I think, are tricky. I've always been a little bit wary of love songs because of this word, one word, cheesy, that I'm afraid of. I don't want to go there. And so circling back to Marfa, I probably up until then didn't really have a whole lot of straight up love songs in my back catalog. And I was listening to a concert by an artist that I like, that I will leave them nameless just out of respect. And he played this love song that I thought was pretty cheesy and pretty lame, and the crowd went nuts. And I sort of had this reaction of, my reaction was, oh man, that's like, I can't believe everybody loved that song. It was so terrible. Mm-hmm. I could write a better song. I could write a better love song like that in my sleep. And that's what triggered me. I had this trip with Marfa. I was in love, and I thought, I'm going to write a better song than that. And this is really the only time I can think of ever being that being the catalyst. Like, I just don't, that's not a thing that really sends me on my way to write songs. I'm just not like that. But in this instant, it was a combination of those things. And then See You and Marfa just here it came. Mm-hmm. And, but the, But it took a long time. It was like I played it for and Marfa, and that was great. And I had the experience of sharing the song with her, and that was a special moment. But then I tried to record it. I was in this side project called NHD with my friends Alex Deason and Billy Harvey, and I wanted to record Marfa for the NHD record, and we did. And at the end of the day, I just didn't think it was the right version. And so I shelved that. And so the song didn't really get properly recorded, or the version that I wanted to be the definitive version, until many years later. So now here we are, almost 8 years after I wrote the song. The good part of the story is I'm still with the girl, and so, everything is good there. And it's really nice. It feels great that it's
Good.
finally coming out, you know?
Well, I mean, we sell no wine before it's time, or whatever the
That's
line used to
right.
be, right?
Good comment.
And I think sometimes, songs are that way too. There's a right time and a right place to express them. Well, I kind of found in a nice contrast is Not Back to Sad, which kind of left me with a sense of the song is about recovery. And that one of the major sources of happiness and help in the recovery is the presence of a significant other.
Yeah, well, that's a good take on it. I liked Not Back to Sad with See You and Marfa because they're a nice positive pair. Musically, they're quite different. Marfa, to me, has musically kind of a wide open feel, almost like 70s Eagles. But Not Back to Sad is more like the Raspberries or the Beatles. And I think you might have mentioned the Beatles, or someone recently mentioned the Beatles, but it's very power pop. And that's an older song that I used to play music with my brother Ferris, and we did a record together years ago called the Nirala Brothers. And right before the Nirala Brothers record, we worked up Not Back to Sad, and we actually recorded it. And it just fell between the cracks. It didn't end up on any record. Sometimes songs, as you said earlier, all things need their time and their place. And sometimes you record something and it's not the right time and it's not the right place, and it's not right. And that's what happened with Not Back to Sad. So when I was compiling songs for Marty Wilson Piper, who was my co-producer, and really more than being the co-producer, he's the one that really selected a lot of the songs and had react I went off his reactions. I was looking through my back catalog of songs for something that I really wanted to blow Marty away with, like stick this in your pipe, Marty Wilson Piper. And Not Back to Sad came to mind, and I also, having distance from it, I spotted some clunky lines. I'm always updating lyrics. I'll be changing lyrics right up until I cut the final vocal. Like, I'm sort of mega OCD when it comes to that. But in this case, this song had a few clunky lines that I made better, and I was really pleased with the update. And when I played it for Marty, he dug it. And so it ended up on the song pile. So, but the vibe, the positivity, and it's another kind of love song, but I like the sentiment of, like, you're saying to yourself, like, I'm never going back to that place. And that place, that sad place, that place of unhappiness, it's like you're telling yourself, you're building yourself up that you're never going to go back to that. You're not going to accept it. And I like that as a sentiment for a song, to, that kind of encouragement. you're done with that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I'm moving forward. I've got better places to be and to go. Sure. I like that too. That's a great idea.
And well, yeah, it felt good with Marfa because I was moving forward.
Sure.
With that,
sure.
You know.
Well, you know, and then you get to hold on to the night is kind of sounds or kind of came across as a, you know, it's a party song and, you know, have a good time while you can, because man, tomorrow I got to get up and go back to work and, or get up and get back to, you know, whatever more mundane activities of life. So right now let's celebrate, have a good time and go with it.
Well, yeah. Well, now that we're talking about these songs, it struck me in its own way, Hold On to the Night is another tale of patience. You know,
okay.
Marfa, I just said 8 years, not back to sad, goes 20 years back to my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And Hold On to the Night was this little idea that came to me one day, which probably someone could guess what came to me first, but it was hold on to the night before you let in the day. It was this catchy little refrain.
Mm-hmm.
And I had nothing else. It was like, and then what?
Mm-hmm. You,
like I loved the sentiment of holding on to the night before you let in the day. I thought it was a catchy melody. And I had no idea where to go with it. So I carted this little idea around with me for 4 years at least. I ended up in a songwriting retreat with my friend Marty McGuire, who plays in the Dixie Chicks. She had a bunch of songwriters come in from all over the country, and I was paired together with people. And at some point, I was with my friend Alex Deason and this guy, Sandy Chila, who's written songs for Britney Spears and other famous people. And we had this minute and I'm like, okay, guys, I got this idea. Hold on to the night. And I rolled it out and we tried to finish the song and it just didn't work out. I knew it wasn't right. And then I was on another gig out of town, and I remember I was with some other songwriters, and I wheeled it out one morning.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and so it was just one of those things I just tucked away, like, okay, maybe someday I'll finish this, or maybe it's never going to go anywhere. And then when Marty came to town in 2018, it was just the first few days of we'd had a tour planned and recording planned, and we were in a kitchen where he was staying, and I rolled out Hold On to the Night, and it was the right moment because he was the catalyst, he was the cheerleader, he was the, well, what if you go here? And so he had this line, one line in particular that jumps out, that's Marty's line, is the sky being full of jewels. And that's a very Marty line, that's a very Marty sentiment, but what it did is it got the whole story tumbling, like, oh, what are these sort of these fun, ridiculous things that you could do? Like, you would never have ice cream in a bathtub, would you? I wouldn't. We wouldn't do that. But, like, it's a fun thing to think about. Like, so Marty was the one that got the song flowing and going. And in this just a couple hours in this kitchen with Marty, I think he was juicing carrots or something while I we were riffing ideas, and then we had a song. And many, many years after the original kernel of an idea was started.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really gratifying.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes you just need to have someone else to bounce an idea off that will come up with, you know, if not the solution, at least another idea that leads you to a solution.
For sure.
Yeah.
And it goes back to a couple things that we've already discussed, which is mixing it up. This is a case of mixing it up because I had another person in the room to mix it up with. and then patience and waiting for the right time and the right to be in the right time and the right place for the song to have its day. I think that this song is a good example of both of those things.
Well, I think, you know, the next song I want to talk about, "Love's a Promise," is perhaps one of the more most serious song on the EP,
from
my perspective. Yeah. In that it sends a signal of one's commitment to commitment.
Yes.
Yet it also comes across as a bit of reticence, or a reticent feeling toward commitment because of self-doubt about being able to follow through.
Well, yes. And so that song came out of the period that I was in before I'd met the girl that currently is the one and was the one, because I recognized that although I liked some of the people that I met and they liked me, I had suddenly become very aware of making that promise again to someone and not being able to deliver on it. Mm-hmm. And I happened to be in Austin at another song retreat with Marty McGuire. And when that song came in, I was actually waiting for Marty, who was late, for our session. And I was in what ended up being a temporary relationship with someone. And I was thinking about how on earth am I going to tell this girl that I'm not the one, I'm moving on, you know, how am I going to say that? Mm-hmm. And I started putting it in this song, and Marty came in and I sort of had most of the song and I wanted her to help me finish it. And I played it for her and she said, "It's finished, Salim. It's done. You just wrote a song. There's nothing I can add to this." And I wasn't convinced, but I ended up taking her word for it. She's a pretty good songwriter herself. And I sat on it for a while and then did a demo of it. And this is another one that had been sitting around for a few years when we started this project with Marty. And I just thought, in a way, because love on the first two songs is a little bit of the theme, I thought it, even though it's not as positive as the other ones, it still kind of ties into them a little bit. And for me personally, in my life, it was part of it all. So that's why it was included on the EP. Yeah.
I see. Well, the last song on the EP, "Hate the Waiting," is a song I have not quite figured out yet, I'll admit.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's a story of one witnessing the suffering of another, or if it's a story of a relationship that is on again, off again in terms of working out. So I've got to have you tell us about it, because I haven't really got it figured out.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and hopefully I can explain it. This one is very autobiographical. I'm a single parent now, because ended up in a divorce many, many years ago, but almost 10 years ago. And a big part of my life these past 10 years has been waiting to see loved ones, not only my children, but waiting to see my girlfriend, my partner, who I don't live with. And so "Hate the Waiting" was a song that was cathartic for me in processing these moments. My house goes from being a place for me of joy when my loved ones are here, and music and laughs and company. And then there are other times when it's very, very solitary. And I like my solitary time. and I appreciate it. And it's time I try to take advantage of, whether I'm writing or doing other things. But sometimes I also hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be waiting for them anymore. I want them here. I wish they were with me. I'm done being alone. So hate the waiting is definitely, that's what it's about. Hating these moments of solitary existence.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it is the opposite of presence,
mm-hmm.
which is something that I'm always seeking, you know, just to be present in the moment. But when your mind is focused on missing loved ones or just feeling like you're just going through the motions, really just to get to when they roll in. So for example, today it's Wednesday. Wednesday is my favorite day because my kids show up on Wednesdays at 5 o'clock.
Cool.
So this is a great thing to be doing, sitting here talking to you right now. And I'm happy for it to go on as long as possible because it closes the gap.
Mm-hmm.
Between
then it helps to minimize the wait.
5 p.m.
Sure.
So hate the waiting is all about that.
I get you. Well, is there anything else that you would like to talk about or add about the new EP that we haven't talked about?
Well, one thing that might be fun to add is it's just been a real thrill to make music again with my band. I have a band. I think they're every bit as good. I hope this isn't sacrilege as the Heartbreakers. I have my own Heartbreakers, which is a Joe Reyes and John DeFilo and Jason Garner, Richard Martin, and then Marty Wilson Piper, who was in one of my favorite bands of all time, The Church. And I've been a big fan of Marty's music for many, many years. And on top of not only all the great music that he was a part of, he's an excellent person.
Mm-hmm.
And Marty brought in this dynamic that was so cool, you know, to kind of join our tight-knit group of friends. And he came in and he really motivated me. He motivated me. It was kind of a struggle to finally get this stuff out because I kept thinking, well, it's not good enough yet. It's not good enough. And it was that, like, the 18-year-old in me that was had first discovered The Church and Hay Day and Marty. And I wanted, it needed to be good enough for that 18-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was the hardest project because we have a whole album's worth of material that's coming out at the beginning of next year. That this EP is of 16 tracks that we cut.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the tracks are coming out at the beginning of next year. And it was the hardest album I've ever made. It was excruciating at times. And I realized because I'd really put a lot of pressure on myself because Marty was involved. It needed to be good enough. And it took me a long time to get to the point where I was able to go, okay, it's good enough now.
Oh, all right. Well, it's a lot of times we struggle with our creation because it's a very personal kind of expression. And, sure. You know, we don't want to have something that goes out that's, half baked or like we're mailing it in, you know, and it's got our name on it, our stamp, and that's really understandable.
Absolutely.
Well, kind of recall, you know, thinking back on your career, what have been some of the most memorable of your musical experiences?
Wow. Well, that's a good question. Highlights, if I was doing like a highlight montage.
Yeah.
being on Conan O'Brien with my friend Rhett Miller.
Oh, cool.
That was a highlight. Conan, I'm 6'2". Conan, I looked up at Conan. He's a big guy. And then that night in our makeup, in our TV makeup, flying into our Boston show. And then my friend Mike Gent from the Figs, there's a great East Coast band called the Figs, which I highly recommend everyone check out. Coming to the show, that comes to mind. Going to Japan, playing in Japan with Rhett was a highlight. Mm-hmm. I was on a German record label for years. All of the trips to Germany, we went to Europe 3 times, and I traveled with my ex-wife and my son who was little, and that was those have got to be highlights. Being on German TV mm-hmm. was fun. Playing in Paris, I just feel really lucky that I've had a normal life, that I've gotten to do music on my terms, and I've had a normal life, and I've been around for my kids. I just feel so lucky because I've done all the traveling, but I never really had to do it at a cost. Like mm-hmm. I feel like artists, like for some reason, I'm on a big Eddie Money kick right now, and I've been reading about Eddie Money, and so I'm going to reference Eddie Money. But he's an example of someone that had no life for something like 10 years because he was constantly touring. Because mm-hmm. when you're famous and when you're that successful, it eats everything. It consumes sure everything. And it's like John Lennon's song, Watching the Wheels. You know, when he walked away from the biz and everybody went, what are you doing? Are you crazy, man? You can't mm-hmm. walk away. I love that song, Watching the Wheels. So, mm-hmm. you know, circling back to your question, like, I'm just like, there are so many highlights of that, like traveling and doing these amazing things, but at the same time, having a normal life, having a great life, and being here for my kids. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've been able to experience it all.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I mean, you're right. There is a high price to fame.
There is.
And when you get to that certain level, you have to tour to support your recordings and support your fan base.
Yeah.
And you know, the popular music industry is so fickle, you don't dare, drop the ball even once, or you could really see, things kind of come crashed around you. And I think there's... a lot of times when I was university professor and I would have students that would come and talk to me about careers in music, they talk about wanting to be a professional musician or a singer songwriter or whatever. And I said, those are all really great dreams. He said, but no matter what you do, even in my, as an academic, you always have to ask yourself, what are you willing to give up?
Yeah.
And what the big picture, when you're trying to figure out what you want to major in or what you want to do for a career, you really have to look at the big picture. And I would always come back to them and say, the most important thing you need to consider is, what kind of lifestyle do you want to have?
Yeah.
What kind of life do you want to have? Do you want to have a life where you're home every night and you can be around family and friends? Because that may or may not be the case if you're on the road 366 days out of the year doing, one-nighters. I mean, that's a rough way to live out of a suitcase.
Yeah.
Some people thrive on it. I remember in a documentary, B.B. King talking about how he loved being on the road.
Yeah.
And some people do, but it's, everybody's different. And like I would tell my students, I said, I chose to become a university professor because A, I love music. B, working in an institution gave me some stability, and a good dental plan.
Yeah.
And yet the freedom to make music in any way I wanted to. And I would say that's why that was my choice and why I did what I did, because I loved the university environment. I loved music, and it was a way to combine those things.
Yeah.
Because you're absolutely right. There's a lot of people out there that, pay a price for that kind of, what they like to do. I have a former student of mine named Alex Smith, who's a blues musician.
Yeah.
Plays guitar with a guy out of Chicago called Biscuit Miller in the Mix. And I think they're currently down in Florida, down in the Florida Keys area. Mm-hmm. You know, and they do 250 dates a year, but he seems to be thriving and doing all that kind of good stuff. Well, speaking of playing or being on the road, Salim, tell us about any live shows that you might have coming up, and also talk about venues where you might typically appear, either in Dallas or around Texas or elsewhere. And are you planning a tour in the near future?
Well, I think the rest of the year I'm going to lay pretty low and kind of keep it to Dallas. I have a recording studio. I've been a producer since, I guess now, for over 20 years, and I have my own recording studio called Pleasantry Lane. Mm-hmm. And next door to the studio, I have a great little listening room. We've been doing acoustic shows, and I've been kind of reconnecting with friends over the last few months and playing small shows just to play again with friends that I haven't played with in a while. Like, for example, next Saturday, I'm playing with a friend of mine, John Leffler, who I haven't done a show with him in 4 or 5 years. And we met many years ago on a Rhett Miller tour. He was in a band called Dashboard Confessional.
Oh, so, sure. I've heard of that band.
Yeah. He's an ex-rock star. And so we're going to do a show just mainly about our friendship. And I think when the record comes out, the full length, which is called A Nuclear Winter, and that's coming out at the top of next year. There are plans with Marty Wilson Piper and his wife Olivia, who plays violin. We're going to do a Texas tour and then try to do some European dates because they live in Portugal. So we'd really like to do Spain and maybe France and, something like that. I'd really like to go to Australia with Marty someday. That would be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's the plan. As far as venues, my favorite venue in Dallas is over 100 years old. It's called Sons of Herman Hall.
Oh, sure. I remember the Sons of Herman
Hall. Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
Over the years, I've done many band shows there. That's my favorite place to do band shows. There's another great old theater on Greenville Avenue called the Granada that I really love. Yeah. My friend Mike Schroeder runs that. And Mike Schneider was always the promoter at the Sons of Herman. Mike Schneider's, my favorite acoustic venue is the All Good that Mike Schneider has in Deep Ellum. Love that place. And then I've got my listening room, which is called Galactic Headquarters, because I also have a record label called Happiness, a record label. And that is our headquarters as well when we're not doing shows. So that's an easy thing for me, because if I can book a show whenever I want with whoever I want, and I don't have to ask permission or get the green light or the thumbs up.
Because you
do whatever I want.
Yeah. That's cool. That's cool. Yeah. Well, if you ever get up my way, we have some. Milwaukee is a very musical town. And there's some nice rooms to play up here.
Milwaukee.
There's Shank Hall. There's
yes.
The Eagles Ballroom or the Rave, which is kind of a club inside the Eagles Ballroom. There's Turner Hall. There's of course. Every summer we have the largest outdoor music festival in the world, Summerfest.
Yep.
that books all kinds of things. So there's a lot of good
Milwaukee
stuff.
is a great place. I met my friend John Leffler on tour in Milwaukee. Our first show was in Milwaukee, and he was playing a ukulele and outside of the tour bus. So hopefully I'll get back to Milwaukee, but probably most likely with Rhett Miller, because Rhett plays a lot in the Midwest, and it's always good when I meet up with him and just come along as the opening act. So
yeah,
I'd love to see you in Milwaukee someday. Fingers crossed.
Well, you know, if I'll keep, I'm on the mailing list for a lot of these places. So when I see you there, you know, I'll memorize this face. It's a face for radio.
And I'll memorize yours.
Yeah, there you go. And hopefully see you sometime.
Yeah.
Well, that's all great stuff. Salim, is there anything else that you would like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
I'd just like to add, thank you. You had really great questions. I really appreciate the intelligence, the enthusiasm, the support, and it's been an honor to speak to you today and be on your show. Thank you so much.
Well, Salim, thank you for taking time to talk with me today. And I want to wish you all the best with what I'm sure will be a continued successful musical future.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
You bet.
It was wonderful speaking with you.
Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
All right. Bye now.
Take care.
My discovery composer of the week is American composer Joel Wallach, born in New York City, June 29, 1946. She spent part of her childhood in Morocco, then returned to New York to attend the Juilliard Preparatory School, where she studied the piano, singing, theory, and composition. She obtained degrees in composition at Sarah Lawrence College, BA, 1967, and Columbia University, MA, 1969, and as a pupil of John Corigliano at the Manhattan School of Music, a DMA, in 1984. She has received several awards, including one from the National Orchestral Association in 1991 for her composition, The Tiger's Tale. Her commissions include a work for the New York City Choral Society in 1994. Wallach's works are widely performed in the United States and Europe, and several have been recorded. Her sacred works use a post-Wagnerian tonal idiom, while the more experimental orchestral works exhibit a wide range of influences, including Hebrew chant and North African dance traditions and effects. The All Music Guide lists 6 recordings of her chamber music, 1 recording of her concerto for cello and orchestra, 2 recordings of her keyboard works, 1 orchestral work, and 17 recordings of her compositions for voice with accompaniment. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube video of Wallach's Runes and Ritual for piano quartet, performed by the James Quartet. Well, that wraps episode number 98. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artist performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. On Monday next week, I'll be interviewing New York City-based jazz vocalist and songwriter Ashley Pizzotti. Ashley is the vocalist with the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra under the direction of Wynton Marsalis. We have a great discussion about recording and performing in New York, especially with the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. Other upcoming interviews include Philadelphia-based jazz trombonist and vocalist Haley Brunell, Nashville-based singer-songwriter Jess Jokoy, Chicago-based free jazz saxophonist and composer Ken Vandermark, and Nashville-based pop country artist Aaron Gibney. So don't touch that dial and stay tuned. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurst@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog signing off from the musical universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.